Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very excited today because we get to talk about, I think, quite an intriguing book, quite a pretty to look at book. So apologies in advance for the podcast medium not having visuals immediately available. But the book we're talking about is titled Drink Maps in Victorian Britain, written by Chris Butler. And I don't want to give too much away, but drink maps might not be what you're thinking they are. There's a lot to explore in this book. So, Chris, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Miranda, for inviting me. And congratulations to you on your book, Securing Peace in Angola and Mozambique from Bloomsbury. Kudos.
Thank you very much. But thankfully, today we're not talking about my book. We're talking about a much more interesting book, yours, All Things Maps. So can you please start us off by introducing yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write a book about drink maps?
I am Chris Butler, a lawyer by training with an insatiable map habit. I never meant to write a book. And as background, as after practicing for 5 years, I really knew practicing wasn't for me. But I still wanted to remain in the law. And for the last almost 20 years, I've been a career coach at a big law firm. But back in 2005, I came across a map collection with a particular legal puzzle. And at the same time, I learned about the International Conference on the History of Cartography, and these things aligned. And so I submitted an abstract about the little maps I had. They had nothing to do with drink maps, but I did present my research and it was accepted. And this really changed my life, because at that conference, which is in Budapest, Hungary that year, I met Nick Millie, who is the map curator, was and still is the map curator at the Bodleian in Oxford. And it turned out he had founded a charitable beer festival in Charlbury and loves beer as much as I do. And we were instant friends. And he brought up then that he knew about a map in his collection that I would love, called The Drink Map of Oxford. So this was the spark. And this map is, it looks like a pub guide. And that's what you might think of when you hear drink map of something. But in fact, these late 1800 maps were made by temperance organizations. And it's the exact opposite of a pub guide. They meant for the maps to discourage people from drinking. So I'll explain more about that later. But over the years, I have been to back and forth to England thinking, well, maybe I will research these maps, and at the next International Conference on the History of Cartography, I'll present that research. And that happened. So I was able to do that in Amsterdam. And so I've been researching these for almost 20 years now, just because that's what I do on my vacation. And in 2019, Nick said to me, you know, have you thought about writing a book? And I had never thought about it. But of course, as you now know, we look back and the timing was perfect. And I started, I did an intentional research trip, and I submitted a draft chapter to the Bodleian Library publishing team. And they said, yes, we want this, go for it. So over time, I did end up, so through COVID, it just worked out because I travel all the time for my job. So to have those evenings free was perfect. And I did write most of it. And I realized where all the research holes were. I took a leave of absence from my job for 2 months. And I moved in the summer of 2021 over to England and filled in all those research holes and then finished the book. So that's kind of how the book came to be.
What a backstory. Thank you for taking us behind the scenes to start off our conversation. I now want to obviously talk about the maps that are so intriguing. Can you sort of take us back in time? When, where, why were these maps being developed? What was kind of the logic of these maps in that context?
There was a lot going on at the time, and historians disagree about why different things happened. So I'll try to put it in a nugget. There was a massive drink problem, and not just in the UK or the US. It was pretty much all over the Western world. And some historians say it was really because, by the way, this is about early 1800s to 1850s when this particular set of circumstances came about. So Industrial Revolution takes place in the late 1700s. And the consequence of that is the population shifted from mostly rural, where people are drinking in the fields, they're drinking at home. They're not so much drinking water. They're really drinking beer as their daily beverage because they didn't know the science at the time, but water had things in it that we wouldn't want in it now, including sewage and so on. And people might get dodgy stomachs. But with beer, they didn't. Beer, when you make beer, you have to boil the water. So they didn't make this connection at the time, but they certainly knew the outcome. So everyone was drinking beer. It was a part of life. You drank it on the job. You drank it at home. Children were drinking it. This was perfectly normal. All of a sudden, people are living in cramped places because after the Industrial Revolution, you have factories and people living in urban areas. And at the time, there's no city planning. So there are few parks, no libraries. Most people couldn't read anyway at the start of the century. And this kind of all created and then at the time there were people talking about comparing, oh, you should definitely drink beer because if you drink a pint of gin, you're just gonna you're really not gonna make it through life. But the idea of even drinking a pint of gin, this was kind of the way people drank. So also at the time, to sell alcohol, a business had to get a license. So we're talking about 1850 onward now, pretty much. And one day a year by statute, usually in the fall, a business owner could apply to a group of magistrates to give them a license to sell alcohol for another year. And usually the only reason to stop a license from happening would be drunk and disorderly conduct the year before. So put that in one corner. At the same time, the drink problem is happening in Sweden, Italy, Canada. They all have temperance organizations growing, saying, we need to stop having so many places to buy alcohol. So the temperance organizations took target at these magistrates who were passing these permissions to sell alcohol in the form of a license. And they realized we could write 1,000 words, or we could show them a picture of a map with how many places there were to buy alcohol. And this would be so shocking that they would definitely agree with the temperance people to not grant any more licenses. So I know I'm leaving a lot out, but that is the sort of nutshell of what was going on at the time.
Yeah, no, that sets the stage for us to then go into more detail about some of those pieces. So thank you for giving us, putting it all together in such a summary. Obviously, there are a lot of details we're leaving out, but that gives us an idea of kind of what we're talking about, where we are, when we are. So can you tell us about those early maps, kind of when they get this idea of a picture's worth 1,000 words, as it were? What did they look like? What was the content included? Were they called drink maps from the beginning?
They were not called drink maps at the beginning, but I'll give you a couple of examples. There was no cohesive strategy at this point. And usually the written word was still the primary focus. So for example, in 1860, what I would call a drink map, but it doesn't say drink map on it, there was a beautiful map that was attached to a pamphlet, 3 or 4 page pamphlet, very typical of the time, by John Taylor, asking that there be fewer places allowed to sell alcohol because it caused poverty in prime. That was another sort of major thinking of the day. It was alcohol causing poverty in prime, not living conditions. And this map folded out from the pamphlet and basically shows, it's beautiful. There are no geographical details on this map other than the Thames River. And there are red dots all over it, looking like almost a disease or a rash. And this was part of the strategy of drink maps, was to kind of get people to think of them as sickness. So it's a map to accompany text. Very typical in the beginning. Another example was a man called Dr. Nichols, and he had a sort of traveling lecture where he had a pamphlet called One Half Mile in the Heart of London. But when he delivered the lecture, he created an 8-foot by 8-foot map to be behind him. So everyone, no matter where they were sitting, could see how many spots there were in this half mile of London where you could buy alcohol. And it's pretty intimidating. And then he had a little mini version of the map that he would pass around with his lecture. So the early drink maps, they weren't called that, but clearly the intention was to shock people by how many places there were to find alcohol.
And when do we start to see them called drink maps? And kind of did that change how people reacted to them? What was the impact of these early maps like?
It's hard to say what the early impact was like, except that they definitely gained in popularity to the point that they did become a strategy for some temperance groups, which I'll get to later. But the first two maps, same year, 1878, different towns, Norwich and Southampton. It looks like the Norwich map was earlier, but they were pretty close together. They were sort of portable 3-foot by 2-foot foldable maps with writing on the back. Both, the writing is not the same. There's no similar or exact language. So it doesn't seem like they knew about each other. But both maps ask people to pressure their local magistrates and demand that they refuse to grant any more liquor licenses. That was the point of both of these very early drink maps.
Okay. And did this become, you mentioned kind of that some groups took this up, and obviously we're seeing it already in two different places, not necessarily coordinated. So this speaks to some element of popularity. How widely used did these drink maps become?
They went from in Scotland and Wales and from all over England, and not just densely populated areas. There are definitely a lot in London, but they were also kind of spread all over England. And the reason for that is because there was one very organized temperance group called the United Kingdom Alliance. They started in Manchester, but they were really, really strategic in how they reached out to other temperance organizations and kind of embraced them. They had a newspaper called the Alliance News where they shared information. So what they would do also is share model language for sermons, for anything that temperance groups wanted to kind of get out. And they had at least three articles about how to make a drink map. These drink maps, for example, the drink maps of Sheffield and Liverpool have identical language on them, both released by the United Kingdom Alliance. And it's because they had this very organized strategy of how to promote the idea of convincing magistrates to not allow more licenses by showing them a map.
And did that work? Did it convince magistrates?
Well, over time, there's sort of an arc of drink maps from 1875 to 1900, where there was sort of a boom of drink maps, and it seemed like every town or city was trying to use this as a persuasive method. At the same time, social reform was really taking off, and by that I mean people were just paying attention to things like water quality, and electricity was replacing gas and candles, and plumbing was coming inside. There were parks, there were libraries, museums, horticultural societies. You could argue that they worked, but people were definitely drinking less. However, on the maps themselves in different towns, because some towns kept making them over throughout the years, there's no real huge reduction other than that that's sort of consistent with social reform. Not so much, a drink map came out and the next year we had so many fewer places to get alcohol. So I don't think they worked at all, which is probably why they weren't used very much after 1900. I kind of guess, as Charles Booth and Lady Somerset said, both social reform researchers, that it's really because people's lives just got healthier and happier.
Very interesting to think about. As you said, the kind of over time, the maps of the places don't necessarily change, but they keep making them. So why? Why, if the numbers aren't necessarily that different, why would somewhere like Manchester or Sheffield kind of have a map that they keep updating or creating new ones year after year or every few years?
Well, I'll pull from one town that I like to think of as the parentheses of this era is Norwich. Norwich has three drink maps. 1878, which I already mentioned, is one of the first, if not the first, to say drink map on the page or on the face. 1892 and 1903. So they really run from the beginning to sort of the end of this era. And all three drink maps were published by different temperance organizations, which is in itself kind of a strange thing. But the base map is the same, meaning the map that's used to put the spots on. And the second one, the 1892 one, does show that there are, I believe it's around 25 fewer places to consume alcohol. I've looked at the map very closely, and oddly enough, yes, there are fewer, but it turns out they're actually more concentrated into the center of the city, which isn't necessarily a good outcome. And then the 1903 one also has fewer, but considering the different changes in boundaries of Norwich over time and so on, it's arguable that actually they didn't have a big change. So they could point to a tiny amount and say, yes, there were fewer, but it wasn't the landslide that really you would have expected or hoped for, maybe, if you were distributing a drink map.
So is that why they stopped being developed and published? When and why did that kind of decline happen?
Right around, well, pretty much people were realizing, because they were still counting, that the towns that had drink maps were, maybe they were going down, some were actually going up, oddly enough. But overall, for the all of England, Scotland, and Wales, drinking was going down in towns that had drink maps and towns that didn't have drink maps. And I think temperance organizers who were aiming at lawmakers, they really were hoping for this change to come through legislation. That's why they were aiming at the magistrates. That's not really where the difference was coming. It was coming from social reform, where people were just, overall, they were drinking less, not because they had to.
Yeah. All right. Well, fair enough. I guess that would make a reason to kind of stop focusing your efforts on this method if there are other ways of doing it. Is that also perhaps why so few drink maps survive? I found this aspect, I suppose it goes back to the behind the scenes side, really interesting. Why don't we have more of them in an archive like the Bodleian?
I'm actually surprised we have as many as we do, because the drink maps were meant to be, they were intentionally ephemeral. They had on their faces the date. Sometimes they even had, well, they had the month. They always had the year. Sometimes they had the month and the year. And Derby, for example, had the day and the month and the year. They really meant to pinpoint a moment in time when those public houses and off-licensed grocers were counted, so they could say, here's accurate information at this moment. So it's almost like today, if you go to a sort of kitschy local place and you get a paper map and it has, oh, here are all the businesses around it, you wouldn't expect a major archive or library to keep a copy of that. That's kind of what they were. They were sort of throwaway things. And one of my hopes of this book is I'm really hoping that there are a lot of drink maps that have survived. I mean, each batch was 2,000 to 5,000 for the most part. I mean, some definitely fewer than that, but that was kind of the average. And to have so few that are known, I have talked to people about this research and they've said, oh yes, my local actually has the drink map of my local on the wall. And this is kind of where I'm expecting them to show up. I think once this book is out that people will say, oh, of course, they're everywhere. I know where one is. That's my hope.
All right. Well, we'll have to stay tuned. That would be very interesting. I guess one aspect then in terms of long-term impact is the hope that there might be more of these out there that we could discover. We don't really have drink maps in this sort of way, though, today. What were some of the longer-term impacts of this temperance work?
Well, fortunately for you in the UK, the temperance work shifted from punishment to treatment at about the same time that in the US, it went from punishment to denial and prohibition. And UK really kept on the balanced path, I think. And the Band of Hope Temperance Group, for example, at the time, in the 1880s, for example, their mission was to educate young people and to get them to sign, and by young people, I mean children, to tell them about the evils of alcohol, to have them sign as soon as they could write a pledge saying they would never drink alcohol. This kind of moral pressure is what they started with. But today, I mean, the Band of Hope has morphed into Hope UK, which still exists today. And it's an organization that has shifted from, instead of punishing and moralizing, into kind of disseminating information, educating people about the health aspects of drinking alcohol. So it is still alive and going, but it's not really temperance in the way of don't you dare drink alcohol. It's, hey, you know, if you drink, here's where to find help, and here's where to, if you want to stop drinking, we can point you in the right direction.
All right. So still there, but evolved in some ways, which is always interesting. I always want to ask this question for anyone who does sort of work like this, look at collection, right? A bunch of maps, a bunch of photographs, a bunch of paintings. But it does sometimes feel a little bit mean, because I am going to ask you if you have any favorite maps that you came across.
I have three, for three different reasons. Oxford, definitely for sentimental reasons. It's the first drink map I saw, and it's where the book is being published. So of course, that is near and dear to me. The drink map of Birmingham, which has never been published, it's in the book. It's so colorful, and it's the first one I saw that had different color dots. It's not just red. It's got green and blue to represent different types of licenses, and it's very beautiful to look at. I think it's one of the most gorgeous drink maps. And then the Darren drink map, which is unknown, the first time it'll be published, is in the book. And I learned about this map because there's a major legal case that happened in the town of what was then called Oberdarwin, which gave magistrates a lot more power to deny licenses. It's a long, complicated story, but I went to Darwin to look at where did all this happen? And I really meant to walk the streets. And it turns out the address scheme has been modified to the point that it's not possible to just see that instantly. So I stopped into a pub, and it turns out the only two other people in the pub are people who were born and raised there. And one of them said, hey, oh, I think I know of a map that might be like that. I knew in the legal case, a map had been submitted as evidence, and I had reached out to every library archivist in the area. No one had ever heard of it. And he sent it to me by email, and it matched up perfectly with all of the newspaper articles of the time of the licenses that the magistrates were going after. I couldn't believe it. And so I sent the map, I circulated it, the digital copy, to all the librarians and archivists I knew. None of them knew anything about it. I still have never seen a touchable copy of this, but it is in the book with all of that explained, that there's no known place, and giving kudos to the person who gave it to me. But that is, I just love that story, because I went into a pub by myself, I met a stranger, had a conversation, and got a drink map. So I feel like there's more of that to come.
Hopefully. I mean, that's a pretty epic story. So thank you for sharing that one and your other two favorites with us. Aside from hoping that people get in touch with cool drink map stories like this, is there anything else you're working on kind of in the future you'd like to preview or highlight?
I am still obsessively researching drink maps, so I don't expect certainly another book, but I do, you know, it was great that there's a book, and I love the book, and I think it's the start. At the same time, I have been teaching, I'm an art history major, and I've been teaching a class called Beer and Art History. I'm also a beer judge for over 10 years now. And I would love for that to be a book, but I think that the question of the images, that everywhere I travel in the world, I drink a beer and I look for a map and I go to a museum and hope I'll find yet a new image or sculpture with beer in it. And I've collected these over the years, and I would love for that to be something. But that's about it. I will continue to study drink maps.
Well, that sounds very intriguing. So thank you for sharing a little bit of your passion with us. Of course, the book is, by the time this comes out, the book is out in the UK, titled Drink Maps of Victorian Britain, and will soon, I understand, be out in the US in early June, I think June 10th. So very soon, listeners all over can get their hands on it and get to see these very, I agree, very cool looking maps. Some of them are quite gorgeous. Thank you so much, Chris, for introducing these maps to us.
Thank you so much, Miranda.